So it is Thursday, November 2nd. My name is Ella Pontier, and I'm a linguistics major and Spanish minor at the University of Texas at Austin. I'm here in Austin, Texas, interviewing Miss Barbara Hines regarding her involvement in the women's liberation movement with Roe versus Wade and other women's rights issues. So Miss Hines, when were you born, and where were you born?
I was born in Chicago on October 29th, 1947.
So what brought you to the state of Texas if you were born in Chicago?
My father was transferred to Brownsville, Texas, to the border. So I moved to Brownsville when I was 9.
You were 9 years old. So what brought you to the University of Texas? And in what year?
So I came in the fall of 1965, and really... It was at a different time, so my parents couldn't pay to send me out of state, and so I applied to one school, which was UT.
And what was your focus of study, or your major, minor?
Latin American Studies and Spanish.
Latin American Studies and Spanish.
Mm-hmm.
And what was your full attendance at the University of Texas, from what year to the end?
I was here from 1965. I graduated in the spring of 1969. During that time, I spent a year and a half in Europe. I was studying abroad for a year in Spain, and I took a semester off. And then I was in graduate school in Latin American Studies in the fall of 1969 and the spring of 1970, I think. Yes. And I had a teaching assistantship in the Spanish department.
That's great. In our preliminary interview, you mentioned that you were active in the WLM, also known as the Women's Liberation Movement. Could you please describe your specific involvement in this revolutionary movement? You had mentioned guerrilla theater.
I was just thinking about the word revolutionary movement. It was revolutionary. I came back to school. As I said, I had taken a year and a half off. So I came back to school in the spring of 1969, and I took a philosophy class, which was something like Marxist philosophy taught by Larry Caroline. And that was a time, you know, when all of us were, I guess, becoming radicalized, were becoming aware of what was going on. It was in the midst of the Vietnam War. I had become very politicized when I was in Europe for that year. And so there were many people in that class that worked on the RAG, which was at that point the underground newspaper. Now people would call it an alternative newspaper. And there I met several people that were involved in the Women's Liberation Movement, primarily Judy Smith. And she invited me to come to a Women's Liberation Movement and to start working on the RAG. And that was how I got involved.
And you also had mentioned in our phone interview about guerrilla theater, about your place with birth control on campus.
Mm-hmm.
And things such as conscious raising and reactions of your peers. Could you go into some more depth, maybe on the guerrilla theater or the conscious raising?
So when we first started getting together in the spring of 1969, it was kind of eye-opening for all of us, because I think was the first time that women really talked about their socialization, you know, and the objectification of women and the discrimination against women. And so that's kind of what the consciousness-raising thing was to have women actually get together in small groups and talk about their experiences and to analyze them and to think about, I guess, the things that women were raised to think about, and to think that they didn't actually have to be that way, that there were other models. So that's what the consciousness-raising thing was trying to get women to talk to each other. There's a lot of discussion about competition between women and really how women mistrusted each other because everything was revolving around finding a husband, having the boyfriend, or whatever. So out of that, we began to sort of look at institutions and to point out ways that we thought these institutions oppressed women, objectified women, led to disparate treatment. So, there was this whole idea of guerrilla theater, and guerrilla theater was not something that we in the women's movement came up with. That was something that had been, was going on across the country as sort of a, and you know, I mean, I think it's interesting, like guerrilla, because this was the times when there were like, you know, wars of liberation around the world. So I think guerrilla sounded good to us. So, but I mean, people had done guerrilla theater in terms of anti-war movements and all sorts of other things. So we, for example, the one that stands out in my mind is that, and one thing to keep in mind is that all of us initially in this group were connected with the university. We were either graduate students or people that had just graduated or in school. So a lot of our initial activities took place on the campus or near the campus. So the fraternities and sororities, the Greek system, in order to raise money every year, and I actually may have these photos, if I can find them, would have women dress up as slaves, and then on the West Mall, they would auction them off to raise money. And so we had someone who worked on the rag, Bill Meacham, and he dressed up as a slave driver, and we dressed up as slaves, and we had our alternative, you know, we actually dressed up as slaves. We were all, like, covered in, I don't know what, blankets or whatever our crazy idea at that time of what, like, slaves from, I don't know where, the Middle East or harem women looked like. And so we did that. We got a lot of press, I think, about that. So we did that kind of guerrilla theater. Another thing that we did that I actually do have some photos of is that we objected to fashion shows. And so it was either fashion shows or was it like the... We also, so we protested, I think it was a fashion show. It was also, you know, they had like Playboy, the girl, the bunny tryouts. I know we protested there. And we...
In the city of Austin?
And on campus.
Oh, on campus.
So all of this stuff was on campus, yeah. I think you could like try out to be a Playgirl bunny. This was either a Playgirl bunny, it may have been just a fashion show. And so our position at that time was that, you know, once again, this was all focused on the physical attractiveness of women. So we dressed up as kind of clowns. We had white faces, and we had signs that said, you know, fashion objectifies women. I don't know. I can look, because I do have some of those, I think. So we did those. We did things of that sort. There were other people, I wasn't involved in this, but there was a thing, I did do this a couple times. We also made, we did do this, something that was called, I haven't thought about this in so long, a cranky, which was kind of a, on paper, a depiction, and two women stood on the end and kind of turned that butcher paper, and we had kind of the depiction of the oppression of women. And we had these songs about women and private property. And so we performed that on campus. So I guess those are the kinds of sort of guerrilla-like sort of, I guess what would they be called now? Pop-up, whatever. But that's what we called it back then. Your other question was, so that was the guerrilla theater we did in the initial days. And, you know, you should interrupt me if you have follow-up questions or whatever. But in the initial days, you know, nobody really knew anything about women's liberation, or no one thought about this. And so one of the things we did is we went and talked to classes. And these were classes of friends of ours that were sympathetic, that taught, that were either professors or were teaching assistants. So the class that I most remember is a friend of mine, Brian Owens, who was a teaching assistant in an English class. Or, wasn't it, maybe it wasn't an English class. He was, it was a class on like youth culture or something, and so he invited three of us to go and talk about women's liberation. And as we went to these classes, I mean, the reaction was very hostile from some sectors. You know, we recruited. We found students that were like, when's your next meeting? I'm coming. But I just remember that in this class, some male student got up and said, you know, the reason you're into women's liberation is because you're also ugly or unattractive or whatever, and that's the only reason you do this. You know, it. You know, as I think about this, you know, we were making a statement. So, you know, you weren't ever going to use makeup. We weren't going to shave our legs. You know, there were just many things that I would say over the years, many of us have moderated. But that's what it was, that was what was going on then.
So when you talk about hostile reactions, would that example of that one student standing up and saying those things, was that normal when you made these classroom
talks? It happened a lot,
talks?
And it must have made a big impression about me, because here we are, you know, what is this, like 50 years later, I still remember that. So that, I don't know why, you know, how things in your, certain things in your memory stand out. Yes, people were very hostile. Yeah, they were hostile.
Mm-hmm. Were there any particular experiences for you where you felt maybe attacked verbally, or just people looked at you and you weren't what they wanted out of a woman just because of your activism on the UT campus?
Yes. I mean, you know, so there was a couple things, you know. I mean, I think you need to look at the women's movement in the context of what was going on. So, you know, this was the rise of student radicalism. It was the rise of sort of the hippie, you know, free love, drug culture. And so we all dressed in a certain way. You know, I think the, like, not shaving your legs and, you know, not and thinking about what clothes you were wearing and things like that, maybe it was more to the women's movement. But, you know... For example, but yes, I think people were hostile. So as I mentioned to you, because of my women's liberation involvement, I have this very long FBI file. And there are some descriptions of people they interviewed saying things like, she wore slouchy clothes, she, what else was it? You know, she didn't do her hair right. So clearly, you know, these were challenging, you know, accepted, established norms about what women were supposed to be like.
And then you also had talked about birth control on campus. Mm-hmm. And okay. How I was very surprised when you told me over the phone that you either had to be married or you had to have proof that you were being married within a certain period of time. I think you said 3 to 6 months,
mm-hmm.
something like that.
Yeah.
What exactly were you doing to try to push birth control rights for all women on campus? What did that involve?
Well, we didn't really do it. I was sort of thinking about this then, at that time, you know, to remember, you know, this is the beginning of the sexual revolution. It's when birth, you know, for your generation, birth control is so... I mean, it's just so acceptable. But you remember, birth control pills, you know, first came out in maybe the early 60s. So the only other way I remember you could get birth control pills is that back at the health center, is back then birth control pills had a really high dosage of progesterone, which was then taken off the market because it was dangerous. But it also cleared up skin problems like acne. So if you went and said you were having a lot of problem with your skin, you could also get birth control pills from the dermatologist. But other than that, you couldn't get it. So we decided that there were doctors in town who were more sympathetic to both birth control and reproductive choices. And so we opened up a small room at the University Y. So the place where most of these activities happened, which was the RAG, which was the underground newspaper, a place called Middle Earth, which did counseling for drug overdoses, and the Women's Liberation Center, or whatever, was all housed in at the university Y, the YMCA, and it's not there anymore. It was first where the Scientology building is on Guadalupe, and then it moved to where we spent most of our time. Was, I would say it was 23, 24, 20 in the 2500 block of Guadalupe, the 23rd, let me just think about this. It was south of the Varsity, so it was between the co-op and the Varsity Theater, which is now something else. Anyway, it's right across from the Student Union. So we had a small room there, and we started staffing it for a couple hours every day. And we would give out birth control information advice. So basically what we did is we told women which doctors they could go to who would prescribe birth control for them. I mean, that's basically what we're doing. And then all of a sudden, and so it was called the Birth Control Information Center. And what I think is striking about it is that we didn't start out doing abortion counseling. We started out with the idea that we would give information about where women could get birth control as unmarried women. And all of a sudden, women started asking us for information about birth control. And that's really how our project morphed or transitioned into being an abortion referral service.
And I still find it very interesting how, so during this time also a sexual revolution was happening. So in my opinion, just from growing up in the late 90s and then early 2000s and going to school right now in 2017, it's interesting that the school wouldn't want to give birth control out to students if they weren't married, because you would think, oh, we could avoid potential abortion issues, or we can avoid teen pregnancy while in college. That's why I find it so interesting that they were so strict on who they gave it to and that only certain doctors.
Well, that's interesting that you say that, because you could say actually that nothing has changed, because I would say that in the era of Trump, that's exactly what they're saying. You know, the idea that even employers shouldn't have to pay for birth control, and the fight now is almost the same, and the same thing about the, what I would say, the anti-reproductive choice abortion people are, that's exactly what you would say. If you want to have less abortion and you want to have like less sexually transmitted diseases and all of those other things, of course you would give birth control. I agree with you. Unfortunately, it seems like those arguments have sort of, we're back to where we were, in my opinion, in 1969. We're having the same fight in 2017. But yes, I agree with you. Logically, you would think you would want to make birth control accessible, of course, but back then, remember, this is when the sexual revolution, or the, whatever you want to call it, is just starting. So for many people, this was for the university or for, you know, certain people in authority, this was a moral issue, you know, a moral issue. I mean, it's interesting, I've never thought about it until you asked me this question, to think about these are the same arguments that people are making today that people were making back then.
And did you ever have any backlash from any university administration or from any authority outside of the University of Texas regarding your birth control information sessions or post-birth control, the abortion sessions that it turned into?
I mean, I'll tell you, the backlash that we had is that we were all surveilled by the FBI. So all of this information is in my FBI file and many other people. So I think that's a significant backlash, that there was like widespread surveillance of women's movement. That anything personally happened to me, other than I couldn't I couldn't pass a security clearance because of all of that later on in my law career. But I don't think anything personally happened to me. But I would say government surveillance of this was a significant invasion of privacy.
And do you know exactly what they were trying to get out of the surveillance? Were they trying to find proof that you women were trying to go against the government?
So
by doing this woman activism?
So I think you have to contextualize this. This is in the era of Hoover, and that there was widespread surveillance of all of the sort of social, political movements of that time. From, you know, Martin Luther King and, you know, all the way to people like me in Austin, Texas, saying that women have the right to birth control, or that I thought the war was bad. So it was really pervasive. You know, the Black Panther Party, the civil rights movement, the women's movement, the anti-war movement. So I think they collected all this data for really disruption purposes, because as we found out later, not so much in the women's movement, but in other movements, you know, there were provocateurs in encouraging people to commit violence. And that's what they found out when a lot of this information was declassified over the years. But why they would be interested in women saying, you know, we have the right to equal pay, and then the only thing I would say is, you know, one needs to keep in mind, although this was surveillance by the feds, I have no idea what the state was doing, but abortion was a felony in Texas at that time. So having an abortion in Texas was punishable by it. It was a felony. It was a criminal offense.
I wrote a media paper recently for this class, and it was about voluntary childless women in the post-war era.
Mm-hmm.
It's something that's always been very interesting to me, and my mom loves that topic because she thinks that women who are able to say, even though I'm the only one, say, out of my partner that's able to have a child, I still have the right to say no.
Mm-hmm.
And that was one thing on all of the medical articles I read, was that there are three different types of abortion. One where the baby's hurting the mother, the mother's in some type of harm to the baby, and then criminal. And most of them were criminal just because it wasn't some medical excuse.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
And then I'd also like to know more about your involvement with the RAG on campus, since the RAG is very well known nationwide, and we've also been talking a lot about it in class. Did you get involved with the RAG right when it started?
No. So we were kind of the second wave of the RAG. So RAG, and there's a documentary out about it. So there were really kind of three waves. There were the original people that started it. And that's Alice Embry, who's the person that asked me if I wanted to participate, Thorne Dreyer. They moved on, and then this group of us took it over. And I would say that, you know, I did very little writing for the RAG. I did the typing and the typesetting, and I went to the meetings. But we were sort of the second group of people that worked on the RAG. And then our group moved on, and then there was the last group, which was a woman named Glenn Scott and some other people, and that's when the RAG closed, I think, in 1972 or 4. So I was not in the we were sort of what I would say. The RAG started in about 1966 or 67, and I was involved in it from between 1969 and late 1970 for 2 years.
And when you did join the RAG, did you have any initial goals?
No, we don't.
Or was it just...
That would be too, like, I don't think we had any goals. I mean, we did have goals. We wanted to have an alternative view to the media. Because remember, this is a time, it's way before the internet, you know, there aren't like 100 alternative viewpoints that you can access at all times. So this was print media with anti-war, with, you know, everything that was going on, sort of, you know, the Black civil liberation, civil rights, the farm workers movement in Texas, women's rights, you know, whatever was going on at that time. And that was all, you know, and it was a very, you know, it was like, I don't know what it was, 10 pages. I mean, it was very, you would look at it now, you know, it was it was kind of, what would I say, not crude, but it was kind of a basic thing. You know, we had to typeset it and type it out. We had to find a printer. It was hard to find a printer. There was a lot of pressure that printers didn't want to print this. You know, they didn't like the language, they didn't like the political views, and so we had to keep changing printers. And so when I was there, we had a printer in San Marcos or something. We had out in the country, and we had to, like, to make the deadline on Friday night. Someone was driving at, like, 2 o'clock in the morning to get it printed so it would be ready, I guess, on Monday or Sunday when it came out.
And so the changing of printers happened just because they were they nervous about...
I think they were nervous.
About the association with the RAG?
Yes, absolutely, yeah. So, so what was the goal? The goal was to be an alternative media voice because we didn't think that what was printed in the mainstream movement reflected what was actually happening in the United States. So I guess that's what the goal was.
And not just you as an individual, but the RAG as a whole with everyone together. Were you all trying to reach a specific crowd? Maybe university administration?
No, because, you know, we had total disdain for, you know, it was like question authority, don't trust anyone over 30, all of those things, which I laugh at now. We were so naive. But anyway, but we were very enthusiastic and very young. And so we probably would not want to have reached them. When we were trying to reach our peers, our audience, younger people, and things of that sort, we weren't really, you know, thinking that we were going to influence the administration. But we did influence the administration, but that was through litigation because they banned the sale of the RAG on campus.
And like you were saying with student protests and the guerrilla theater, with the slave auctions and whatnot, and peers' reactions, were there any hostile reactions to the sale of the RAG on campus?
Well, yes. The most hostile reaction was that the Board of Regents said prohibited it from being sold on campus. They said you couldn't sell it. And Dave Richards, a civil rights lawyer who was married, was the former spouse of Ann Richards, the governor, went to court, and he sued and got an injunction on First Amendment free speech grounds that allowed us to sell the RAG on campus. So that was a very violent reaction to try to suppress free speech, to suppress the media.
Mm-hmm.
And the university lost.
And did any writers in the RAG use any pseudonyms because they were afraid of peers' reactions, like that someone would come up to them
with
violence or hatred?
No. I mean, I'm actually trying to think about... I'm sure we must have gotten hate mail. I don't think our office was ever broken into. But to my knowledge, at least at the time I was there, nobody used a pseudonym.
No. And even though you weren't one of the initial members of the RAG or one of the ending members of the RAG, what impact did it have on you as a person? Just an overall impact, whether big or small?
Well, I would say the the biggest impact on my life was the women's movement. You know, for those 2 years, I lived, breathed, it was all I did in terms of the women's movement. So that was really my focus, less than the RAG. But all of that, you know, I think laid the foundation for what I'm still doing today, which is social justice work.
And then I'm also curious, since you're not from Texas, and were your parents born in Texas, or were they also born in Illinois?
No, my parents were born in Berlin, Germany.
Berlin, Germany.
Mm-hmm.
So what were their views on what you were doing while you were a student at the University of Texas?
So my parents were very liberal. They were Europeans, so they didn't have the hang-ups. So, you know, many of my friends during the sexual revolution, living with your boyfriend, getting birth control, meant your parents disowned you, they didn't talk to you. Remember, people that go to UT, many of them come from very provincial, conservative, small Texas towns. I didn't have any of that because my parents were very liberal. But I went much farther to the left, and I think at some point they thought, oh, she's going to, like, run off and join I don't know what. the armed revolution. I say that as a joke. But I didn't, you know, I think sometimes they thought that my ideas were pretty far to the left, but I didn't ever have any trouble with any of that. I didn't have any problems with my parents, unlike many of the of my friends at that time.
That's why I was curious.
Yeah, no. And in that sense, I feel like I was really lucky. I didn't have to go through that conflict that everybody else did with their parents.
So you studying abroad and then also your parents being from Germany and having a different viewpoint than many Americans during that time, would you say that influenced you just in general?
Yeah,
in the movement?
You know, I really think, I mean, so I had a much more liberal background. When I was 17, my mother was worried that I was going to become too provincial, and so she sent me off to Mexico City when I was 17. She was the original gap year mother. I left high school early. But I actually think what influenced me the most was the times. I mean, this was just what was going on. And now that I look back on it, I realize that this was sort of my vocation, social justice, because I have a lot of friends that, you know, smoke marijuana, probably showed up for the anti-war protests, but they didn't kind of make it their life, the central focus of their life. So in that sense, I do think my experience at the RAG and at the women's in the women's movement and some like Latino labor work really influenced me a lot. I didn't know it at the time. You only think about these things when you look back historically, with the looking back at your life.
And you also had involvement with Roe versus Wade,
yes.
That is correct?
Uh-huh.
How did you form a relationship with the attorney, Sarah Whittington, who worked on the case with Jane Roe?
So, when we were doing abortion counseling, are we doing okay for time?
I think so.
Yeah. I mean, I have time. I don't know what your time is like. So we sent women to a doctor. There was a doctor in Texas who ended up being a plaintiff in the lawsuit. I can't remember his name. But we also sent women primarily to a Mexican doctor in Eagle Pass. Well, he was actually in Piedras Negras, across from Eagle Pass, on the border. We sent women to New York. In New York, I think if you had mental health issues, you could get an abortion. People that had a lot of money could go to Europe. But at some point, we were worried that that we were going to get charged as like co-conspirators. And what was our legal liability for actually providing information so that women could access an abortion, which was a felony in Texas? So we only knew two women lawyers, one of whom I ended up doing some work for before I went to law school, and Sarah. And Sarah was a friend of Jim Wheelis, who was at that time the partner of Judy Smith, who was probably she was the most influential person in this whole Roe v. Wade struggle, except for Sarah. And we knew Sarah through Jim, because Jim was in law school at the time. And so a group of us approached Sarah. So one day we had a garage sale to raise money. By then we had rented a house and we had like a women's center, which was on something like 22nd and Longview. Someone had rented, gave us an old house. And we then finally had an actual house as opposed to our little one-room closet at the University Y space. And so we were raising money to pay the rent or I don't know what. And so we had a garage sale. And Sarah, I always tell the story, like, none of us lived in housing that even had a garage. Like she was married. We were, you know, in student housing. Nobody had a garage. So she lived, I don't know where she lived, but it seemed like she lived more in a established neighborhood than we students did. And so we decided we were going to have a garage sale there. And so we were sitting around in the morning saying, wow, I wonder if we could challenge the
Texas abortion laws. How would that happen? And so that was the genesis of this lawsuit. Now, there were other challenges around the country. So it wasn't as if, wow, we just sort of came up with this idea. But we were really talking to her about, could it be challenged and what would our liability be? But really we approached her initially as like, what's our liability? What could happen to us? And is there any way to challenge this law? And so that is how it began. I was not a lawyer then. None of us were lawyers except for Sarah. She was already a lawyer. And so then she took this and went off. But I went to law school because of all of this, and then I worked for Sarah while I was in law school. So she then got elected to the legislature. She was a state legislator when we were trying to reform the Texas abortion laws. And so I worked for her for maybe 3 or 4 months while I didn't work on Roe v. Wade, but in her office when a lot of this was going on.
And what, do you know the exact years you attended law school?
Yes. I started at the University of Texas in the summer of 1972, because UT, the law school, accepted a summer class. And then I thought the law school was too conservative for me, so I went to Northeastern in Boston, which was 50% women at that time. So I was in Boston for a year and a half, and then I came back to UT, and I graduated in the spring of 1975. So law school is basically 3 years, 1972 to 1975.
And going to a different school, going to Northeastern, did you learn anything different about yourself as a student? Or did it make you think of anything that you did in the women's liberation movement? Since you said that the UT law school seemed a little too conservative for you?
Well, there were 10 women and 190 men in my class. So going to Northeastern had just reopened, and it billed itself as a law school for a law for social change. So the student body was very different. It was all activists. It was very many people like me. It was 50% women, which was shocking then. You know, I taught for 16 years at the law school, and when I went back and there were 50% women, and I tell my students that there were only 10 women in my class, they're looking at me like I'm from the dark ages. It wasn't that long ago. It was, you know, being surrounded by a lot of women that were, you know, into many of these issues. So I guess that's what I learned. But I also learned, you know, yeah, that's it, mostly.
And were there any particular cases of anyone you personally knew, or maybe a friend of a friend, regarding abortion, when you said that you were trying to help certain women find places to get abortions outside of Texas so it would technically be legal?
You know, most of the, we didn't really know many of the women. They would call, and we would tell them to come in because we didn't want to give the information. It was a pay phone that rang, which I'm sure was tapped. There were little clicks on it. So as we learned about all this surveillance, they would be listening into this telephone line. So we told women to come in. Of course, I think we were so naive, because if you really wanted to know what we were doing, all you would have to do is send in someone posing. You could just send in a cop or an undercover agent posing as a young woman, mm-hmm. you know. But somehow we thought that it was better to do it in person than to do it on the telephone. So, you know, I don't know who all these people were. The only one I really remember was a high school student. And she was from Lockhart or from, you know, some little town, and she had come all this way trying to figure out how to get an abortion. I don't remember her name. I don't remember what she looked like. I just remember thinking, wow, you know, she's in high school and she found us and she lives in some little town. So I remember that case.
So the women that came in to the abortion center, were they typically young women around high school, early college age?
Yes.
Or
yes.
Is it a mix of everybody?
No, it was young women and college age. Because remember, to know about us, once again, no internet, no social media, you had to be reading the rag. Or somebody had to have told you about it. Yeah.
And then not too long ago, you just said that you weren't particularly working on Roe versus Wade, but being in an office where they were working on it, yeah, talking about it,
yeah,
what types of feelings and emotions did you have regarding this case, or just things related to it?
So what I really remember is being so elated the day the decision came down. I was in Northeastern, and I kind of remember I was on the street, and I just couldn't believe it. And what I really think about it is that, and I think Sarah would say this too, is that we thought, okay, that case is done, now we're moving on to the next issue. And so I remember being so excited that we had won in the Supreme Court, only to think that we're still fighting this, you know, 1973, what is that, 50, whatever, in 2017. You can do the math. And so I remember that I was on the streets of Boston when it was decided, and I was so excited. It was incredible. And that's where I think sort of my naivete and others to think, well, that's done. Now we have a Supreme Court case, and now we'll move on to the next women's rights issue.
Having those feelings of happiness and excitement when you found out about the case, and like you said, how that time period correlates with this time period now with all that's going on with Trump's election and whatnot. How does that make you feel? It must be frustrating.
It's really depressing. It's really demoralizing. But you have to think about it as a long-term social struggle, because otherwise, if you can't look at it sort of on the arc of history, you have to give up. But it's really bad.
And how long did you work with Miss Whittington?
Whittington, so Northeastern had a co-op program, so where you came for 3 months, so I worked for him for 3 months, 3 or 4 months. And so it was when the legislature, she had an office in the legislature, and she had an office here because we were working on other issues. So, one of the issues that, you know, was, did I do this with her or with Bobby Nelson? For example, we women had to take their husbands' names when they got married. So at one of these two places, we worked on that. There was all this issue about credit. You couldn't get credit. It had been your husband's name. But it was 3 months. But Sarah was, we were trying to liberalize the abortion laws. So this was before Roe v. Wade, it must have been, when I'm trying to think about this. Let me just think about this, 72, 73... Because we were trying to change the Texas law. So this must have been before the Roe v. Wade decision came down.
And when you said that you worked on women's last names and how once they got married they had to take their husband's name.
Yes.
What type of work were you doing when it came to
that? I was doing research. So I think this was actually, so before I went to law school, there was another lawyer whose name was Bobby Nelson. So I only knew two lawyers, women lawyers. And so she was either litigating this or trying to get it declared unconstitutional, either in the state court. You know, I wasn't a lawyer then, and so I just was doing what she told me to do, and I didn't really understand what the process was. So I can't really tell you whether she was doing this administratively. I know, like, you couldn't get your driver's license in your maiden name. You couldn't keep your maiden name. But I don't remember in what context she was doing this. But we were doing a lot of research on these discriminatory state laws.
And did you make any progress while working on it?
Yeah, you don't have to change your name anymore. You can get a driver's license here in your own name. I think we actually got that changed that year. Yeah. I mean, I think many times young women really don't understand and become very complacent, particularly about reproductive rights. Maybe when, you know, maybe when there is no more right to abortion given the constant, you know, the makeup of the Supreme Court. But I think that young women don't really, not you, but women, young women in general, don't really understand. Because you're, you know, this generations of women have grown up thinking all of this stuff is normal. I mean, normal. That you have the, you should have equal access and the same treatment as men. But it was very different then.
The whole taking the last name when you get married is interesting to me because my mom, when my parents got married, she didn't want to get rid of her maiden name mm-hmm. and didn't want to make it her middle name.
Yeah.
So she decided to hyphenate it.
Mm-hmm.
And legally, it's been the biggest mess for her ever. So she basically only uses her maiden name. Right. And it's funny that now in the 21st century, people still get very confused, mm-hmm. even me being a young adult.
Do you have a hyphenated name?
I don't.
Yeah.
But whenever they... She technically goes by her maiden name,
yeah.
so whenever I write my name and then say I write an emergency contact, I usually put my mother.
Yeah.
And I put her down, and half of the time I get questioned, oh, is this really your mom? She doesn't have your last name.
Yeah. That's crazy. Yeah. Yeah.
It's
that's
just,
amazing.
It's
yeah.
just really funny how that's still prevalent today because some people just don't think about it.
Right.
But then I know so many women... who I have a little sister who's a senior in high school
mm-hmm.
and a lot of her friends' parents sadly have gotten divorced, and the moms, all of them had taken the husband's name
mm-hmm.
and they get divorced, and after they had already changed their name once, they didn't want to do it again,
right.
so they just keep this name.
Yeah,
that's another thing that's also very interesting to me, is that what happens in a scenario like that? Do you just well, it's been my name for a while,
yeah.
I just give
and
up
and that's
or...
what most people I know do, but that's that they don't change your name in the first place. Makes it easy.
Were there any laws with regarding divorce and name changes when it came to women's last names?
That's interesting. I don't know. I mean, now you can, in the context of a divorce, you can get an official name change. But if you take someone's name, then you have to actually include it in your divorce decree. So I don't really know about whether you would have to go and get an official name change or whether you had to keep your husband's name. I don't know the answer to that.
And I'm also curious to know what the opposition was like during the release of the outcome of Roe versus Wade.
Well,
because I'm sure that not everyone was as excited as you were.
Yeah.
And
I mean, so interestingly enough, I think the opposition was less organized, really was. I mean, sort of the rise of the religious right and sort of the sort of right-wing organizations was really in some ways a reaction to what happened in the 60s and the early 70s. So I remember... I know that we had a demonstration at the Capitol, and there were probably people who were opposed to abortion, sort of the counter-protesting, but the really, like, the right-to-life organizations and, you know, the people protesting the abortion clinics or murdering doctors and all those other things, that really came after Roe v. Wade as a reaction to Roe v. Wade. So clearly there were people that opposed it because it was illegal in all of these states. And so one by one there were efforts to change the laws, and, you know, the law changed in California, in the usual places, New York, Massachusetts, New Mexico, Colorado changed at some point. So yeah, there was like fervent, there was a lot of opposition because the state legislatures had outlawed abortion.
And then
I mean, ironically, this is just an aside, is that, so when I had a private practice, my office is on East 40th Street, and that's where there was a medical facility, it may have been the Whole Woman's Health, but it was an abortion provider, and it was right next to my office. And I thought, this is very ironic.
Yeah, what a
because
coincidence.
Those people protested every single day. And I never had a confrontation with them, but they were like right next to my office. And I thought, this is ironic, right? Then they did.
So they were anti-abortion.
Yeah, so there was my office, and right next door to it was an abortion clinic. And so every single day there were people out there protesting.
Protesting the clinic, okay.
That's right. And there was only one time where we had a screaming match, but generally we never had any conversation. But I just thought, if they only knew, it's like right next to my office. Yeah. But I didn't think it was worth having a conversation with them.
And while you were in law school, you first thought you were going to work on women's rights law.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
What specifically did you want to work on while you still were thinking you were going to do that?
Well, I mean, all of women's rights law, you know, gender discrimination, equal pay, you know, those sorts of things, fair pay, you know, Title 7. Discrimination. Well, Title 9 is also, but I wasn't really into the sports stuff. You know, whatever came along, but mostly probably employment discrimination.
Mm-hmm. So when was it Equal Opportunity or Equal Pay Act with John F. Kennedy?
Yeah.
We were learning that they had a committee, and most of the people on the committee, it was for minorities and for women and for discrimination in the workplace, but they were mostly all focused on African-American rights.
Mm-hmm.
Do you think, I personally think it's very surprising that they didn't want to push more women's rights, because within African-Americans, you also have African-American women.
Yeah.
And I know that, I think when John F. Kennedy was still alive, that the head of that committee was an African-American man himself,
mm-hmm.
and he had said that he sympathized for the women's cause, because when he thought of his mother, his wife, he could feel the sympathy,
mm-hmm.
but he still didn't work towards that. And do you have any experiences or maybe your own rationale to that?
Well,
as to why they didn't want to make it a joint cause and they made it more separate?
Well, so, you know, because the women's movement comes later, and believe me, there was so much sexism even into what was called the New Left. Within the rag in the early days, the women did all the typing. By the time we got there, no, but like, I think the women that worked on the early rag will talk about this. So there was a lot of sexism every place. It just wasn't really, and it didn't really kind of come really into the forefront, I would say, until the mid, you know, the late 60s. So that's one thing I think about it. The other thing is, I think, you know, people choose their issues, and for the African American community, predominantly, it really was race discrimination. And then second of all, and then the last thing is that, you know, there was criticism about the women's movement as being sort of a white, primarily middle-class movement. It wasn't always, but I think there were divisions. So maybe for all of those reasons. But it is true, you know, the people who suffer the most discrimination are African-American women. You know, when you look at pay scales, it's men, women, and then women of color.
Yeah, the whole idea of intersectionality.
Yeah, exactly.
Is there anything that I've maybe missed in asking you, or is just maybe a story you'd want to tell?
A story. Oh my goodness. A story. It's hard to think about all those stories. I can't think of any right now. No. I mean, I guess, no, I would just say that they were really exciting times. That is one thing I'll say. For all that, the many steps backward we make, they were very heady days. I think we really thought we were going to... And I think, you know, one thing is to look at it thinking we did make some progress, as depressing as things look now. But they were very exciting times.
And do you still keep in contact with the women and the men that you worked with during your times at UT? whether it be the rag or the movements you did with the WLM?
I'm in touch with a few of them. You know, there's a few people in Austin that are still working on, you know, kind of progressive social issues. I mean, we had a reunion of the rag 10 years. There was another, I was unfortunately, well, not unfortunately, my grandson was born the weekend of the last rag reunion, and so I missed this last one. But 10 years ago, we had one, and that was actually really amazing. And we kind of had a getting together of our group and the women's movement too. So I don't stay in touch with a lot of people. Some, but not a lot. No, you know, people's lives go different places. You lose touch, people move away.
Would you say that the basis of your career stems from what you did in college as far as activism?
Yes.
Working, pushing for human
yes.
rights,
yes.
women's rights.
Yes, I feel like it just moved into another area, but clearly.
So while for some people it may have just been a movement in a specific time period and then they remembered it or maybe forgot about it and just continued on with their lives,
yeah.
It was not that case for you.
No, it was definitely, it still definitely is not, no. And so I feel very lucky. That's kind of how I would look at it. I feel very lucky.
And then when did you decide that you weren't going to work on women's rights and then move on to immigration?
So I did one case. So I went to legal aid because I wanted to do something in sort of the public interest sector. So I was hired here at legal aid. And I did one employment race and sex discrimination case at legal aid. And then really what happened is somebody said, you speak Spanish, and they handed me 30 immigration cases, and I found my life's work. So it really wasn't, like I said, I wasn't going to do it. It just didn't happen.
Something else was thrown your way.
Something else. It's like you're coming to school here. That kind of was thrown my way, and it turned out to be the perfect work for me.
That's great.
Yeah.
Well, unless you have any last comments or remarks regarding
no.
this, I think that I've asked you all that I wanted to ask.
Great.
You.
All right.
Thank
and
you
so
much.
Are you writing a paper? What are you doing with this?
Yes, I will be writing a paper.
Uh-huh.
I will be using your interview
uh-huh.
as almost a skeleton
uh-huh.
to the paper. So then from here, I can look at secondary sources.
Okay.
Look more into the women's liberation movement
yeah.
and the rag as well.
Yeah. So the rag, I think, is on microfilm at maybe the Barker Center. So, you know, we wrote stuff about, so we wrote about women's abortion and stuff in there. We, you know, so I think that would be helpful. Sarah's book is good. Yeah. There's a guy who wrote, there's somebody else who wrote his whole, God, what's that his name? I have that book. There's a person that wrote a whole thing on the history of reproductive rights. He's a historian, and I got interviewed for that book. Anyway, I'll send you it. So there's some stuff about the women's movement here, too, in that person's book.
Great.
Yeah.
Well, thank you so much, Mrs.
Great.
Hines, for your time.
Yeah,
really
no, it was great. Well,
it.
Good luck. What year are you in school?